Recording in progress.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening, good morning, whatever time it is, wherever you are, whenever and whatever time you're listening to this. It's nice to see all of you. Very exciting, actual people in a room. It's a wonderful thing. Well, tonight I want to bring up a chapter of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that is very famous. And I think we haven't talked about it yet. It's called Nirvana, the Waterfall. And I'm bringing this up because Chris reminded me of it. It's one of her favorites, she says. And she brought it up because some of us were talking about Carolyn Meister, whom probably all of you know. We lost, I think it was the 18th of March, when she was out hiking on the horse pasture trail outside Tassajara, and she somehow fell and hit her head and fell into a waterfall, or near a waterfall, and she died. And they found her body finally after a long search in a little basin at the foot of this waterfall. She was only 30 years old, and her practice of devotion and kindness was really remarkable, and it was an inspiration to everyone who knew her. So we've been thinking a lot about her, and Chris was saying, yeah, the waterfall reminds me of the passage in Suzuki Roshi. So that's why I'm bringing it up tonight. And in this passage, Suzuki Roshi uses the river and the waterfall to talk about life and death, as he understood life and death. And he begins by mentioning the river that is flowing near Eheji Monastery, where he lived just for a little while when he was young. And this is what he says about that river. If you go to Japan and visit Eheji Monastery, just before you enter, you will see a small bridge called Hanshaku-kyo, which means half-dipper bridge. Whenever Dogen Zenji dipped water from the river, he used only half a dipperful, returning the rest to the river again, without throwing it away. That is why we call the bridge Hanshaku-kyo, half-dipper bridge. At Eheji, when we wash our face, we fill the basin to just 70% of its capacity. After we wash, we empty the water toward, rather than away, from our body. This expresses respect for the water. This kind of practice is not based on any idea of being economical. It may be difficult to understand why Dogen returned half of the water he dipped to the river. This kind of practice is beyond our thinking. When we feel the beauty of the river, when we are one with the water, we intuitively do it in Dogen's way. It is our true nature to do so. But if your true nature is covered by ideas of economy or efficiency, Dogen's way makes no sense. So I guess a lot of you know that tonight we're going to do a special ceremony. I hope to talk not so much so that we have plenty of time for that, to honor our women ancestors. It's the month for that, and next month is the month for the earth. So next month, probably at the end of our in-person seminar, at the end of the month, we're going to do, as we did last year for the first time, a climate repentance ceremony. And in that ceremony, we read Thich Nhat Hanh's words about loving the earth. he says in there something like, actually, you are the earth, and the earth is you. This means that we are I and thou in the Buberian sense, you know, I and thou with the earth. That we love the earth, and the earth really does love us, and we come alive with the earth, and the earth comes alive with us. And the earth is alive, and therefore, like all that's alive, awesome. This is something human beings, I think, have always understood. But for quite a while now, some of us have been enthusiastically missing this point as we've been rushing around using the earth for our inventions and our improvements, as if the earth were not alive. We're not worthy of careful respect, as if it were an it, not an I thou, not a you, a thing to be exploited and used. And every one of us has benefited from this use of the earth. But now we come to see that it's unworkable. And I really hope that our practice, as Suzuki Roshi is expressing it here, remembering how Dogen dipped water from the river, will give us a feeling of respect and identity with the earth, and that we will learn how to stop using her as an object, stop abusing her. And isn't it just like our relationships with one another, human to human? When we use one another without realizing maybe that we're doing that, forgetting that every person is not just for us, every person is alive and awesome in their own right. When we forget that, and we define one another and categorize one another, then we lose track of ourselves and one another, and we become really unhappy. And we have a really hard time understanding what love is. So we're learning, we're trying to learn how to treat everything, even the air we breathe, with love. And I know that in a couple months we'll be having a precept ceremony, and that's what precepts are about. That's precept practice, to treat everything with love, including our own mind and our own body. And I think that's what the monks at Eheiji express when they dip and return the water from the dipper, and when they pour the water toward themselves out of respect. You treat things with love when you realize that we are all one together in the wide circle of birth and death. So next comes the famous part about the waterfall. I guess Suzuki Roshi was really enthusiastic because he went to Yosemite. He had never seen anything like it. So this is what he says about the waterfall at Yosemite. I went to Yosemite National Park and I saw some huge waterfalls. The highest of these is 1,430 feet high. And from it, the water comes down like a curtain thrown from the top of the mountain. It does not seem to come down swiftly, as you might expect. It seems to come down very slowly, because of the distance. And I bet everybody here has seen that slow waterfall coming down in Yosemite. And the water does not come down as one stream, but is separated into many tiny streams. From a distance, it looks like a curtain. And I thought, it must be very difficult experience for each drop of water to come down from the top of such a high mountain. It takes time, you know, a long time for the water finally to reach the bottom of the waterfall. And it seems to me that our human life may be like this. We have many difficult experiences in our life. But at the same time, I thought, the water was not originally separated, but was one whole river. Only when it separated does it have some difficulty in falling. It is as if the water does not have any feeling when it is one whole river. Only when separated into many drops can it begin to have or to express some feeling. Isn't it a wonderful image to think of our life as falling off a cliff into space? A drop of water in a waterfall, leaping over, and then down, down, flying, soaring. Oh.
What was that?
I don't know. It's a mystery. Anyway, I'm thinking of this, you know, drop flying through the air. It sounds exhilarating to me. You can imagine how brisk the air is, right, with all that water falling. And you can hear the really exciting sound of the waterfall made up of all the other drops along with you, falling, falling, falling down, soaring downward through the air. I refer again to Ann Lohr's talk from a week ago, I think, here in the seminar, when she brought up the Sandokai, which is a Zen poem that many of you know. And as she said, Suzuki Roshi also lectured about this poem in another book called Branching Streams Flow in the Dark. In that famous Zen poem from the, I think, Tang or Song Dynasty, it uses the metaphor of darkness and light to describe exactly what Suzuki Roshi is talking about here, using the metaphor of the river and the waterfall. In Sandokai, darkness means oneness, total peace, like the river in this metaphor. Here he says, the river, the water in the river doesn't have any feeling, any exhilaration. It's just calm and perfect and unmoving, just a big body of quiet water. And that's what darkness means in Sandokai, this quietude, this perfection, this settled feeling of oneness. And light means difference, separation, like the individual drops separating to make a flashing curtain of falling water. And then he says, when the drops are separated, that's when they have some feeling. Maybe they're excited. Or maybe they feel like, wow, anything could happen. But because they have some feeling, they also have some difficulty. Maybe when you heard the drop falling, you thought, wow, that's terrifying. It's also terrifying, right? To fall down to the bottom without any control whatsoever about what's going to happen. Maybe it's difficult and very lonesome to be a drop separated from all the other drops. But that's what makes a waterfall, the separation. Without that separation, there's no waterfall, there's no beauty, there's no feeling of being alive. It is such a beautiful feeling to be alive. And also, as we know, it has a lot of sorrow in it too. All kinds of pain that we can feel, will feel, because we're alive. But this is what we have. This is our gift. And this is what our task is, to live. And what a great privilege it is to have this assignment. Live your life. That's what you have to do. Be humanly alive. Fall down from a great height into this perfect river. He goes on, now I'm back to Suzuki Roshi's words. Before we were born, we had no feeling. We were one with the universe. This is called mind only, or essence of mind, or big mind. After we are separated by birth from this oneness, as the water falling from the waterfall is separated by the wind and the rocks, then we have feeling. You have difficulty because you have feeling. You attach to the feeling you have without knowing just how this kind of feeling is created. When you do not realize that you are one with the river or one with the universe, you have fear. Whether it is separated into drops or not, water is water. Our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore, and we have no actual difficulty in our life. When the water returns to its original oneness with the river, it no longer has any individual feeling to it. It resumes its own nature and finds composure. How very glad the water must be to come back to the original river. If this is so, what feeling will we have when we die? I think we are like the water in the dipper. We will have composure then. Perfect composure. Composure is a word Suzuki Roshi uses a lot in Zen Mind, beginner's mind. And I think we all hope that at some moment, when she fell and hit her head, Carolyn had this feeling. Even if in other moments she had other feelings like startle or surprise or terror, we hope she also had that feeling. And I hope we can all have that feeling of returning to the river, returning to oneness when we die. When he says, when we realize life and death are the same thing, we will have no actual difficulty in our lives. I think he really means this. I think he's being serious. He says no actual difficulty. I think he means that even when we have difficulty and things are tough, and they always are sometimes tough, it won't fundamentally bother us, because we will understand the difficulty. We won't push it away. In other words, these teachings about life and death, river and waterfall, light and darkness, are not abstract, religious, philosophical teachings. They're really about the way we live our lives all the time. He goes on. again about the waterfall and the river. It may be too perfect for us just now because we are so much attached to our own feeling, to our individual existence. For us just now, we do have some fear of death, but after we resume our true original nature, there is nirvana. That is why we say, to attain nirvana is to pass away. To pass away is not a very adequate expression. Perhaps to pass on, or to go on, or to join would be better. Will you try to find some better expression for death? When you find it, you will have quite a new interpretation of your life. It will be like my experience when I saw the waterfall. Imagine 1,430 feet high. And I'm continuing with Suzuki Roshi's words. We say everything comes out of emptiness. One whole river or one whole mind is emptiness. When we reach this understanding, we find the true meaning of our life. When we reach this understanding, we can see the beauty of human life. Before we realize this fact, everything that we see is just delusion. Sometimes we overestimate the beauty, sometimes we underestimate the beauty, sometimes we ignore it, because our small mind is not in accord with reality. To talk about it this way is quite easy. But to have the actual feeling is not so easy. But by your practice of Zazen, you cultivate this feeling. When you can sit with your whole body and mind, and with the oneness of your mind and body under the control of the universal mind, you can easily attain this kind of right understanding. Your everyday life will be rewarded and renewed without being attached to an old, erroneous interpretation of life. When you realize this fact, you will discover how meaningless your old interpretation was and how much useless effort you had been making. You will find the true meaning of life, and even though you have difficulty falling upright from the top of the waterfall to the bottom of the mountain, you will enjoy your life. I remembered the other day that someplace in the Pali Canon, and I avoided the rabbit hole of trying to look it up, somewhere, there's a sutta that talks about a king who is shopping around different spiritual groups. And he decided that he liked the Buddha Sangha the best because the monks in the Buddhist community seemed happy. And it was pleasant to be around them. And this is kind of funny because people over the years always used to complain about the Zen Center monks being very crabby looking. So serious and grim all the time, which I assume that has changed, but I don't know. But they used to complain about that. You look grim when you think the practice is serious and important, and therefore you are probably doing it wrong. This can make you look grim consistently. But when you think that the practice is serious and important, but that everyone in the universe is practicing one way or the other, and that there is no way to do it wrong, then you can be very happy and you can enjoy your practice and your life. And I find it very odd that Buddhism so explicitly emphasizes suffering so much. And yet, it really is a path of happiness. Usually, we think we will enjoy our life when everything is good, and everything's in order and nothing is going wrong. But in the Buddha Dharma, we know that everything is impermanent, everything comes to an end, everything that we wish to cling to, we will lose. So we know things are going to go wrong, of course. And yet, when we really understand what all that means, and as Suzuki Roshi here says, we digest that understanding through our years of Zazen practice, we are happy anyway. And we can enjoy this amazing life. Kathy and I had a wonderful visit the other day from our son Aaron. And he came with a friend of his who was a really interesting guy. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. He got the Pulitzer Prize for, he explained to us, for this book that he wrote, I think about a year ago, where he wrote the history of a small county in the state of Alabama. And the theme of the book was freedom, what freedom meant in this small county in Alabama. To these people, he explained to us, what freedom meant, as it means to so many people today, is the freedom to control life as they see fit, and not to have a big government from far away who has no understanding of their way of life and culture come in and tell them how to live. That's why in that county, they say that the real issue of the Civil War was the question of freedom. And they really mean this. Unfortunately, their freedom had to do with the oppression of others. And freedom is like that. Sometimes my freedom is your servitude. In Buddha Dharma, I was telling Jeff, the historian, in Buddha Dharma, we also seek freedom. But the freedom we seek is not from a government. It's freedom from ourselves, the greatest tyrant of all, the first and most powerful tyrant, the source, really, of all tyranny. And when we are really free from ourselves, we cannot ever oppress others. And that's what Suzuki Roshi is talking about when he speaks of our erroneous interpretation of life. We all have a very firm interpretation of life, deeply held, and we don't even know that it's an interpretation. Self, self-interest, self-view is an interpretation. It is not a natural fact. We automatically assume self, and then we live that way, and this makes us suffer a lot, and it makes other people suffer too. Sometimes I joke with my friends in the conflict resolution business. I work with them, you know, doing things, and sometimes I say, isn't it an amazing thing that when you're in a conflict, 100% of the time, you're on your own side, not the other guy's side. Did you ever notice that? Always. Why? Because, of course, who doesn't favor themselves? There would be no conflict, right? Otherwise, we don't think about it. We just automatically, of course we do. But what if we loved everyone else the same way we love ourselves? Not less, not more, but the same way, with forgiveness and appreciation, as if we knew that we were all drops of a great waterfall falling together at the same pace, in the same way, and with the same destination. As I was thinking about this talk, I got an email message from Miles Cowherd, who is the current Shusoa at Tassajara in the practice period. And he wrote to invite us all to come to the Shuso ceremony, and then he wrote to say, don't come, because they didn't want this influx of people in the valley at this time. And he wrote about the long search, and what it was like for them to be spending days searching for Carolyn with lots of local authorities. There was a huge number of people trying to find her. And he said that Carolyn's parents came, and they joined the Tassajara community in their grieving. So I want to end my talk with just a few sentences from Miles's email. Maybe some of the rest of you got it too. I took Carolyn's father, John, to the airport to comfort his daughter, Liz. Jean, Carolyn's mother, has been staying with us and will return home with Carolyn's ashes. Jean has filled us with grace, attending three ceremonies in Carolyn's robes and rakasu, and shared with me that there is even some beauty in all this. I write this message as the moon sets, shining its light over the western hills, and the beauty and grief shine on the topography of our hearts. So what I would like to do, just to take a few minutes first, is for us to do a very brief meditation. And then after that, to do our groups of three only, we'll do them more briefly than usual. And what I'm wanting us to meditate on is all of this, the darkness and the light, the river, and the drops of the waterfall, and what it's like really and truly to be in this leaping, short human life. So with whatever image that is in your mind, whatever way you can bring this great theme to a point, let's just sit for 1 or 2 minutes and breathe with the feeling that you have right now. So now, let's get in groups of three, and we'll do it here in the room spontaneously. And as always, if you can be in a group with someone that you don't know, so the newer people can get to know the old timers, that's good. And what I'd like you to do in the groups, and that's true for the people online too, very quick, we're going to do no more than 2 minutes maximum for each person, and you can self-time. And in a poetic way, in a non-linear way, without, you know, figuring anything out, just express your feeling right now. Express your feeling coming out of that meditation and coming out of this contemplation of Suzuki Roshi's words. Just 2 minutes or less, each person, okay? So everybody's in a group, and that's going to happen online in a minute. And good luck, everybody. We'll see you in maybe less than 10 minutes. And then we'll have a chance for general comments.
Recording stopped.